This from Mark's Gospel, chapter 9. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his garments became glistening intensely white as no fuller on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking to Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it's well that we are here. Let us make three booths, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." For he did not know what to say. They were exceedingly afraid. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. Well, this is one of the places from which we get the cliche, the mountaintop experience. Jesus takes his disciples up on a mountain, and suddenly the voice comes, "This is my beloved Son, listen." And Peter says, "Let's live here. We want to stay on the mountain." Intriguingly, the people that put together the liturgical year place this story on this Sunday, right before Lent. The mountaintop experience leads us to Ash Wednesday and a 6 or so week period of much quieter reflection, maybe confession, maybe amendment of life. Who is he? Who does he want me to be? From the mountain into the valley leading to Easter. That's the theology of the Transfiguration and of the placing of it in our year. You're on the mountain, but you can't stay there. In our house we have, I suspect, what a lot of folks have in their houses and hallways or spare rooms, something of a rogues gallery, you know. In-laws, outlaws, people still with us, people that are only with us kind of on the wall. And I was in our guest room this week looking at where that's where our gallery is, and I was caught by this particular picture. And I know it's a little bit hard to see. It's a picture of, it's my grandma, many years ago. There was no date on the picture. And as best we can figure, knowing the year she was born and kind of how old she sort of looks in this picture, my guess is that this picture was taken somewhere between the start of the Great Depression and Pearl Harbor Day. Kind of an interesting period in our history of economic uncertainty and warfare. And yet here she is, you know. And I want to say, gosh, why couldn't she stay right like that? She's self-assured, she's attractive, she's on top of the world for at least a 60th of a second, one moment in time. Because I also know if that picture was in fact taken somewhere between 1929 and 1941, she was married to a man who brought her great misery for reasons that are far too complex to discuss right now. She didn't stay on the mountain if that was the picture when she was there. And yet we need those mountaintop experiences. We need the moments to celebrate. You know, if you have an obsessive person in your life who is involved in photography, you've probably got a scrapbook somewhere in your house, or you know someone that does, that chronicles throughout the course of a year the mountaintop experiences. You know, if you grew up in Wisconsin, starting around in January, there's pictures of kids sledding down the hills. It's awesome, right? And a couple of months later, the tulips are up and the daffodils and so on. And then there's the Memorial Day picnic, all the kids and the ice cream and so on. Then there's the 4th of July picnic. And there's the Labor Day picnic. And Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas. And you have these high moments, good times, that we need. They give us strength, the moments we celebrate. And even when we think about the season of Lent coming up, and a lot of people do some contemplative things, maybe they give up something for Lent and do without and enter into Jesus' sacrifice. I may be the only minister that will tell you this, that technically and liturgically, if you give up, let's say you give up chocolate for Lent, just metaphorically, The Sundays in Lent don't count. You can eat chocolate on Sunday. There's a reason for that. Every Sunday is an anniversary of Easter, and that liturgical import overshadows the contemplative piece of Lent. We need the moments of celebration to both not just endure, but learn from the time in the valley. Learn from the time in the valley. So we celebrate on the mountain. We draw strength from the experience. But we still walk through the valley. And sometimes the valley is overshadowed. You know, perhaps you've had the experience of hoping someone didn't take your picture right about then. And yet these days, with everybody got a video camera, it's hard to not be caught in the act of the things that, you know, we sometimes have to contemplate when a reflective, sometimes confessional season of Lent comes around. And sometimes, even though we may have just been at the top of the world, it doesn't take long to find ourselves in the valley. I remember calling my grandma many, many years after this picture was taken. It was 1984, precisely, in the fall, when our own beloved Chicago Cubs won the division championship. They didn't win the World Series that year, obviously, but they won the division championship, and I called her. I said, "Oh, Grandma, they just won." And she said, "I just lost my Clarence on the same day." And this was the man who was, in effect, her fifth husband. You know, number one here, number five on the day the Cubs win. That's the reality of how it goes. And I have mind pictures more than photographs of time in the valley. And when I think of my grandma, I mostly think of the golf game that she taught me. And I have one last image in this section that relates to that. She had an extraordinarily unusual golf swing. And part of it was related to an arthritic shoulder. The backswing was pretty strange. I mean, it was sort of a corkscrew thing, and she wound up leaning forward before she'd hit the ball. But after all that sort of drama in the backswing, somehow she squared up the club and hit it 170 dead down the middle every single time. And I talked to her about that because we played a lot of golf, and you know, people would even stop and look from the other green like, "What in the world?" And then bang, you know. And the mind picture I have of that swing goes with the lesson I learned. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. Doesn't matter what happened before. If you can square that club up when you hit it, it'll go straight. And for all the drama of her life, 4.5 husbands worth, nobody got more out of country music, a baseball game and a hot dog, and a martini than she did. It's how we get through. So we gain courage when we remember the moments in time. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. Mountaintop, valley, and in any and all places, one moment in time is a time to pray. And, you know, there are disciplines of Lent that involve maybe more praying than we might otherwise, meditations and so on. But think about the things for which we typically pray. Confessionally, praying for guidance, praying for other people, or maybe just saying, "Oh, God," as in, "I'm frightened," or "I'm thrilled." It doesn't take but a moment in time to offer a prayer about a circumstance, about something you've done, left undone, or maybe most profoundly, a person. An insight floated out of cyberspace into my world this week, and I was caught by the sentiment in a way that doesn't always happen. The phrase was this: what if you could only have today what you thanked God for yesterday? Now, if that was true, we would have a much less benevolent God than the one we've got. But it's an interesting lesson in values clarification. If you could only take with you today what you expressed gratitude for yesterday, it sort of brings up the imperative to thank God for somebody in your life. Because clearly the most valuable of all that I have are the people who love me. And it only takes a moment in time to say their name with gratitude. A moment in time on the mountain to draw strength. A moment in time in the valley to remember, learn, and have some courage. And a moment in time to pray with gratitude and with hope. Well, I guess it's picture day. I have one more to show you. These are two little babies. These two little babies, this picture was taken on their birthday, which was 8 days ago. And they're twins, obviously, a boy and a girl. They're my niece Laura's first and second child, Sonia and Gabe. And the picture was texted. My sister texted me the picture. And in the text message, she goes, "They're not fighting yet." And I'm going, "Yeah, well, give them time." And it kind of reminds me of the refrain in that wonderful Christmas carol, "A Little Town of Bethlehem." "The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight." And of course, the Christmas song focuses our attention on the baby Jesus. And I draw from that this week the hopes and fears of all the years that will come to these two. Well, they're kind of focused on Lent this year, because, you know, these two essentially came off the mountain 8 days ago, and who knows what lies ahead? None of us do. We know that there are great things and terrible things that they will experience, and we draw our hopes and fears around their little lives as well. It's illustrative to me that the end of this transfiguration story leaves the disciples with Jesus only. They've had this experience of, it's a vision of Moses and Elijah, the voice from heaven, "I love you guys." And suddenly the only one that's there is Jesus. And it's with Jesus that they walk down the mountain. And it's with Jesus that we walk into Lent, a season of reflection and contemplation, maybe confession, maybe amendment of life. And yet within which are moments in time where he is with us and gives us strength from the celebration, courage from the memories, and hope in the prayers. They saw only Jesus, and it was enough. Amen.